Athens, please welcome to the stage, Telling Tales, Mr. Stephen Fry.
Well, bless you. I love you too. You are? Yes. That's lovely. You've had your say now. Thank you. No, you are officially, darling, you are overspilled. Pleased to be overspilled. It's a nice thing to be. Oh, I'm so incredibly happy to be in London. I always enjoy coming here. I know that's something all visitors to a city say on stage, oh, it's my favourite city. So it's not my favourite city, I'll be perfectly honest. But you'll like me a bit if I say that, nor is Sydney, so that's all right. Actually, I was talking to a friend. This may not be an original observation, but I think it's very pertinent. Sydney and Melbourne are a bit like sisters, one of whom is incredibly pretty and beautiful and courted by all the boys, and the other who is a little bit plain, a bit dowdy perhaps. And then, over the years, the plain dowdy one is the one who speaks four languages, has an art collection, reads books, has a sophisticated cultured manner, and yet also a street vibe, makes incredible coffee. And the pretty one starts to look a bit haggard. So, things have turned out very well tonight. Yeah. I do love this pacing up and down. I'm going to do something. I've never done this before. As far as I know, it's never been done in the whole realm of show business before. Is I'm going to start measuring my walking now. How's that? Yeah, come on, let's get started. Is Louise here from the Apple Store in Chadstone? Give a squeak if you're here. Yeah, hello. Very nice. I can't recommend it high enough, if you can afford Chadstone shopping centre. But it's, I was walking this morning along the array of houses and beautiful trees where the Yarra River flows. And I was thinking, what a marvellous place it is. Australia generally, Melbourne in particular. Almost flawless. I say almost, because there are faults. One of them is a shortage of, obviously, trams and buses in Melbourne, because a lot of the young people who you might expect to use public transit were having to row into work. And that's awful. I mean, rowing is fit only for galley slaves and convicts. Tactless, I'm of course. It's in the blood, isn't it? So sorry. And another thing is, you'd think Australia, of all countries on earth, would be the least likely to be nanny statish about things. But you're going into a 7-Eleven, you know, in the CBD. So called, it would seem, because there are at least seven of them every 11 yards. you know, you ask as you would in any country for an e-cigarette, vaporizing, taking a little bit of nicotine to suck away in the steam. And apparently it's illegal in this country. So instead, you have to smoke a cigarette. And they keep them in a cupboard. And I don't know, about the third or fourth time I came here, I collected the whole set of the Cadbury's Furry Friends chocolates. It's a ring-tailed possum and a hairy-nosed wombat and a bilby and a dingo, and I can't remember all of them. It's wonderful. And now, of course, I'm collecting the set of wonderful illustrations on the tobacco products. You go in and you say, darling, how
have we already got necrosis of the kidney? I'll have that one. The gum disease is lovely. I'll have one of those. And the, the pulmonary edema is going to make the toes all yellow and crispy and oozy. I'll have one, and then you build up a whole collection. Presumably what the government wants. Anyway,
I should tell you a little of my history in Australia. I came here first in 1981. It was a very different country then. It was as beautiful as it is now, obviously. It was, I won't say the word backward, because Britain was backward. In fact, we were forward in certain things like eating and drinking. But it was a world of rather large, empty spaces, cinemas where the young people had nothing better to do than roll Jaffers down the aisle so that people could crunch them on the way out, and then they're maddened with too many pints of frosted Milo, they would roll around giggling. It was a simple, innocent time. The only drug was violent crumble. But it was also the time I discovered the Australian accent, because British people had been rather unaware of it. It had been very badly done by British actors and comedians, as you're about to hear soon. But its nuances were absolutely a closed book to me. And the first city we went to, and I was with my friends from university, Emma Thompson, Hugh Laurie, and others, and we were doing a show. And the first place was Perth. And we were in this sort of motel where the promoter had put us. And I sat in the bedroom and tried to put them together a television channel, and I got this channel. And it was called 6KY. And they were having a telethon. And the man advertising the telethon said that there was a bear that you could bring in and bid for, and that it was ideal for gift giving interstate and overseas. And I thought it was terribly sad that this man had an acid reflux problem. But then someone came with some room service beer or whatever and said, before I called us. I realised an enormous number of Australians seem to have rather a problem getting the bridge out for that huge esophageal reflux. So that was one. And another was, well, it was diphthongs. It was an advert for a product called Doc Vinyl, and that just takes one into the kind of country Australia was then. Doc Vinyl was a glue that was meant to repair rips in the kind of vinyl that you would have on your leatherette banquette, in the kitchenette and your dinette. And it wasn't a very expensive advertisement. You saw a piece of leather like that in perfect condition, and then suddenly there was a ripping noise and a rather bad, hasty jump cut, and then you saw a rip right down the middle. And a voice off said, "I know it!" Did that come from human lips in your throat? That's very odd. So I rushed to where Hugh's room was, and I said, "You've got to turn on the television. There's going to be an advert for Doc Vinyl, and we've the two words, O and No, you count the vowels in the word O. I count them in the word No and see how many it is." So, sure enough, after the telethon bear, ideal for gift-giving interstate and overseas, it was time for Doc Vinyl. I know! 19 vowels. Pretty impressive. So, how not, I mean, how could you not fall in love with an accent like that? Certain things disappointed. It's not a comic observation, really, it's a feeling of regret that you decided to ditch the mile and the foot and the pound and the inch and embrace the rather cold, hard, rational and unlovable French metric system. It doesn't doesn't belong. See, I mean, the imperial system obviously sounds terrible if you call it imperial, but the old, you know, foot, inch, those sort of things, they're connected to the human body and miles. It comes from the Latin, miles passus, 1,000 paces. And a yard, you took some cloth, put it on your nose, pulled through, that's one, drop it. Two, three, that's how haberdashers used to count out yards of cloth. See, it's related to the human body. The meter's nothing, it's an idea of Napoleon's. and just arithmetically speaking, I need hardly remind you, the 10 is not a very divisible, factorable number. Just 1, 2, 5, 10, that's it. Whereas 12, if you're a decimal 12, which you get inches and so on, that's, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 12. It's much more factorable. Divided up. And after all, the Americans who kept it, they got to the moon and back using inches and feet. So, all I'm saying is, don't quote me amiss, because I'll be all over the papers for the wrong reasons, but he could have got rid of the monarchy or he could have got rid of the metric system. I just feel, anyway, up to you. Thank goodness, it's very particularly British being asked all the time, because your politics seems to lurch from exciting crisis to exciting crisis. And one is reminded of the greatest crisis of them all, and I was still alive, most of you were, but then, when John Kerr sacked Gough Whitlam. Yeah, this is still rankles, isn't it? But trouble is, a lot of people think John Kerr, because he was Governor General and he was Sir John Kerr, this must have been British. He wasn't. In fact, the Queen hated him, did you read that? Yeah, she really thought he was nasty. I have family in Australia, talking of politics. My father's second cousin was an MP, an MP for Canberra. He was called Ken. About a cousin, but he was of a generation where I think you had to call your sons Ken. Or Walter or Les, but certainly one of those, and he was a Ken. Now, oddly enough, if you called your son Ken, you'd probably have the child taken into care. You wouldn't want to do that to anyone. But Ken Fry was a liberal sort of chap, so I thought he might be a member of the Liberal Party, because you assume that the Liberal Party would be full of liberals instead of being full of foam-flecked maniacs. We were talking about how related we were, and how many relations he had in England, and other people there who said, "Oh, you know, my name's Clark. There have been Clarks in Yorkshire for the last 400 years." And I bethought me of a story about Kublai Khan. I don't know if you know who I mean. He's the grandson of Genghis Khan, who was the great Mongol emperor and wielder of power, and he lived on horseback and ate babies and was generally somewhat to the right of Tony Abbott. You know what I mean. Coleridge wrote a poem, famous poem. Xanadu did Kublai Khan, stately treasure dome decree, where Elf the sacred river ran, Cavern's measureless demand, down to the sunless sea. And it's a beautiful poem. And he was an extraordinarily rich man. He was the grandson of someone who had been the greatest conqueror in world history up to that time. And like a lot of rich, powerful people, he was fanatically bored, didn't know what to do from one day to the next. He had everything he wanted and therefore he had nothing. And he summoned his viziers, his scientists, his scholars, his magicians, his artificers, his engineers, and he said, "I want to play a game. I want to play a game that is totally without any element of luck. be a game of skill I can master. So the door went off. He said the prize would be whatever they wanted. He would bestow on them whatever they required. So they went off, and then the day came, and they gathered like a sort of one of these baking or cookery shows in front of their own produce. And he wandered around trying the manners. One game was very, very good, but it was not much good to him because he only worked on Xbox. And there was another version. It could have turned out to be backgammon, but it required a throw of the dice, so he dismissed that. And then at last he came to this game on a very small board, just 8 squares by 8, and little wooden pieces lined up in 2 rows facing each other, black and white. And he said, well, what's this? It looks very dull. And the inventor said, well, Imperial Majesty, this piece here is like the Persian emperor that your father defeated, the Shah of Iran. And the Shah must be protected at all times. And you must attack the Shah on the other side. If you so attack him that he cannot move, you can cry in Farsi, Shahmat, Shah is dead. No, okay. Checkmate? No, Shahmat, checkmate. Well, that's interesting. Right, okay. And he starts to play. They play a game, and the inventor wins just. The second one, he lets the emperor win. The third one, he lets the emperor win. The fourth one, he wins. And the fifth, just to show, is a proper game. And then the emperor really gets it into his system, and he wins, and he wins, and he loves it. He loves this shahmat game. He thinks it's magnificent. No element of luck. Only element is, if you're white, you have the first move. As long as you play enough games where you're white and you're black, there's no problem. So he says, well, name your reward. And the inventor says, well, I'm a very simple man. I have a family. I have 7 children I need to support. You see this board here, 8 squares by 8. Would you perhaps be kind enough to give me a grain of rice on the first square, and 2 on the next, and 4 on the next, doubling each time? And Kubla Khan's supporter, he gets, what a fool, he calls for a bag of rice, and they move away the pieces, and there it is, 8 by 8. One piece goes on what we call in modern parlance A1, or the Queen's Rook one, and then 2 on the next one, B1, 4 until it goes up until H1 at the end there, where the King's Rook lives. And by that time it's 128, so it needs to be put in an egg cup and popped on there. And then they carry on doubling, they carry on doubling. By the time they get 2/3 of the way along the second row, one of the court mathematicians whispers in Kubla Khan's ear. He says, Majesty, I'm sorry to have to tell you. This man has asked for what you have agreed to give. More rice than there is in China and India and all the world. That's what you mean. He says, well, I have done the calculation, Majesty. There is not enough rice in the world to fill that last square. So Kubla Khan does what any leader, reasonable ruler would do. He has the inventor's head sliced off. But it was a lesson in the form of mathematics called geometric progression, the exponential excitements that happen. Perhaps another way of describing the same thing, just as I am, is if you took a piece of paper, any size, square piece of paper, it would be huge, it would be tiny, it would be vast, it would be bigger than MCG, it doesn't really matter. And you fold it in half, and then you fold it in half again, which is a similar principle, of course. You're doubling the thickness of it each time and halving it, as it happens, the surface area, but you're doubling the thickness by in half. If you did it 51 times, which you couldn't do, you could only fold a piece of square paper 8 times. There's no more can be done. It just becomes impossible. I tried when I was a student and I was eating out laboratory paper. But if you could do it with a computer 51 times, you would have a piece of paper, no matter how thin it was to start with, that would reach from here to the sun, 93 million miles. That is the power of just doubling and doubling and doubling. Now, I mention this because we are one. We are on square A1. We are one person. We have two parents. We have four grandparents. We have eight great-grandparents, 16 great-great-grandparents, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, 2048, 4096, you get the point. It doubles each time. And by the time you get to a certain number, in other words, a certain generation, your ancestors become not hundreds of thousands, but millions. And so, if any of you has a spot of British blood in you, then you are related to Henry V. You must be, because you have more ancestors in England than the population of Britain. And even allowing for a lot of incest, it's still too many for you not to be connected. So when someone says, oh, I have a clerk who's a member of the family who's been living in Yorkshire, for, you know, we've been clerks all this time, it's a meaningless thing to say, and it's merely a result of the accident of what you might call patronymics, the fact that we name ourselves after our father's blood. So we name ourselves after our father, and in terms of the grandfathers, the father's father, the father's father's father, the father's father. But that's only one. Each one of the hundreds of thousands of ancestors, when you go back a very small number of generations, is as responsible for our existence as the one with our surname. Obviously, they're all as responsible for our DNA. So, I first saw this idea, oddly enough, expressed beautifully by the writer E.M. Forster in an essay called On True Consciousness. And he said, if we forget all the possible immoral horrors of being conscious of whether or not people are Jews and whether or not it makes them different, we first have to ask ourselves whether we are Jewish. And he said, I challenge the Prince of Wales, this was in the 1930s, who comes from the most famous family in the world, I challenge him to name his eight great-grandparents. I certainly can't name mine. What about my 16 great-great-grandparents? One of them is Jewish, then I am, to all intents and purposes, a Jew. But what that's really saying, in a very simple, hippie-ish way, is that we are all brothers and sisters. We are all descended from the same stock. You don't have to go back to Adam. You only have to go back a few hundred years. So, you call yourselves proud Australians who know the burglar convict from whom you are apparently descended. You might, I'm horrified to tell you, also be descended from some hideous English governor of New South Wales. But it's a nice thought that we are so exquisitely connected. And it's particularly nice, I think, to think of a particular descent that we all share, that is especially relevant in this city. More than all cities in the world of one, this is relevant. Now, I sometimes get in a bit of trouble because, well, people think I'm a fanatical atheist or something. I'm not. I find it very difficult to believe in the current slew of gods on offer. They don't convince me either metaphysically or physically or morally or ethically particularly. But I don't have any real quarrel with anybody else who happens to be pious and devout and follow their own god. That suits me very well. But I wanted to share with you the fact that I do actually believe not in God, but in something else, something from which we are all descended. And I think there are some magnificent stories here, so it would be worthwhile, I hope, sharing them. And I'm talking, hence the relevance of Melbourne, I'm talking of the cosmology, or cosmogony is the correct word, I think, of the ancient Greeks. I was obsessed with Greek mythology from a very early age. I had the good fortune to read Robert Graves' book on Greek mythology, and I found all the stories in quite marvellous. And I have recently been reacquainting myself with them, because I just thought I'd take another look, and I saw the Graves book on the bookshelf and I picked it up. So let me tell you how the universe was created, in case you didn't know. It started with a being, an entity called Chaos. Chaos is not quite the sort of Brownian motion, the haphazard sort of chaos that we think of today. It's more of a sort of yawning, gaping sort of thing, chaos. And chaos one day, no one quite knows why, chaos vomited up Nyx, Night, female entity, and Erebus, darkness. And they produced Day, Hemera, and they produced two twins, Hypnos, Sleep, and Thanatos, Death. But then, the most important birth, Gaia, Mother Earth. Gaia was born, and the next supreme being was Uranus, Uranus. I'm allowed to love. Get Uranus out of the system. But we'll mostly call him Uranus. Uranus. Uranus was the sky, and Uranus covered Gaia. And they had issue. They had 12 children who were titans. Oceanus was one, Rhea was another, Mnemosyne, memory, was another, Phoebe was one, and Cronus. She also gave birth to three Cyclopes, Stereops, and Brontes, and Ares, who are thunder and lightning, and the light that comes from them. Get our word Argon from Ares. And Brontosaurus from Brontes. And she gave birth also to three very horrible, extraordinary creatures, the Hecatoncheires, that means hundred-handed. 50 heads and 100 hands. And their father, Uranus, hated them. He hated them and he buried them deep in the earth. In other words, he buried them deep in Gaia, caused enormous pain. And she decided to plot against her mother, Uranus, the sky. And she asked the Titans, the 12 children, if they would side with her to defeat him. And none of them would. They were all afraid of him, except Cronus. Cronus said, I'll help you. I'll help you defeat him. What do I have to do? She said, well, I have made this sickle from grey flint from adamantine. I want you to take the sickle. And about 6 hours' time, we'll run the other side of Mount Erythros. And it'll be time for our 5:30 shag. And you are to surprise us, and he will leap up and you must kill him with a sickle. He did as he was told. Uranus and Gaia were together. He came round the side of the mountain with the sickle. He swooshed it down and he castrated his father. Blood spurted from him, and where it fell into the ground came the Erinyes, the Furies, and the Gigantes, the Giants. With a scream of triumph, Cronus took the genitals of his father and he hurled them into the sea. And they fell near Cythera. And you can think, from such a horrible act of parricide, such a horrible act of castration of the father, that whatever happened in the sea would be ugly and horrible. And what happened was it started to fizz and to boil, and on the surface came a froth and a spume and a foam. And from the foam arose not just something very lovely, but beauty itself. An extraordinary woman, exquisite beauty. And because she came from the foam, the Greeks called her, after Aphros for foam, Aphrodite. The Romans called her Venus. You probably know the Sandro Botticelli painting, The Birth of Venus, in which she stands in a scallop shell, covering her body like that, with her hair. hair beautifully done, birds in London, and when she made her way to Paphos in Cyprus, which became her home, wherever she trod her feet, flowers bloomed, animals adored her, twittered around her ears, Facebook did under her eyes, no shit. It's a very beautiful thing to be born, but Uranus, meanwhile, calls out a curse on his son Cronus. He says, as you have destroyed me, so a child of yours will destroy you utterly and thoroughly. Well, Cronus doesn't think much more of it for the time being, because he has to go to war against the Titan brothers and sisters of his. He has some on his side, Rhea, Hyperion, Hyperion's son, Prometheus, and a few others, but a few of them are very, very powerful. Atlas, for example. And there's a 10-year war, the Titanomachy, which is extraordinary. And in the end, with the help of the released Hecatoncheires, you remember the 100-handed ones, Cronus wins, and he puts, well, he puts a lot of them into terrible punishments, compresses them into mountains, where they still, to this day, steam away in Etna and places like that. And they rumble and occasionally spit fire out of the mountain. And Atlas had to hold up the earth. But Cronus didn't forget the curse that was on him. And he plucked out Rhea to be his consort. And she had children. But each time she gave birth, he took the child and swallowed it whole. So he took a girl called Hera, swallowed her whole. Took a man called Hades, swallowed him whole. Another man, Poseidon. Another woman, Hestia. And by this time, Rhea was getting extremely annoyed. she not only went through the agony of childbirth, but the extreme annoyance of sex with the Titan, and she got nothing to show for it. So she was pregnant again, and she decided she would go to Crete and secretly give birth, as she did, to a little boy whom she called Zeus. And she left Zeus in the care of a nanny goat called Amalthea, who suckled Zeus, and she popped him in a cradle, suspended, because Cronus' imperium, his realm, was the sky and the earth, being the child of Gaia and Uranus. And so she thought if he was between the two, he would be safe. Meanwhile, Zeus grew up alone, except the company of the nanny goat, and the occasional visits of his mother Rhea, and he learned to hate his father. Much as Cronus had hated Uranus, Zeus hated his father. And she told him the stories of how Uranus had been defeated. Uranus, I should say, was compressed into rock. Compressed so hard that all his power existed in this rock. And a curse was put upon it. That no one in future years, no matter how far away, should ever be so foolish as to attempt to tap the power in the rock named after Uranus. Uranium, it's called. And no one, of course, would be stupid enough to try and use the power of uranium, would they? Anyway, eventually Zeus is old enough to take on his father, Cronus. He goes back to Mount Erythros, where they live, and with his mother, they mix a truly revolting, a disgusting concoction, an emetic, so that anybody who tasted it, this dark, horrible, sort of waxy stuff, would instantly throw up. They called it Vegemite. They fed it to Cronus, and he threw up. And he threw up Demeter, and he threw up Hestia, and he threw up Poseidon and Hades. Hera. And these brothers and sisters of Zeus then fought with Cronus for another 10 years until they were in charge of the cosmos. Cronus was reduced into a shriveled old man, still with the sickle with which he had castrated Uranus, and became a symbol of the eternity with which he was to wander the earth, of time itself. Kronos was old Father Time with the sickle, and he used his word in chronometer, and synchronicity, and so on to this day. So that was the fate of Kronos. Meanwhile, we had Hera and Zeus, who rather fell for each other. And we had Poseidon and Hades and Demeter and Hestia, all family together. Zeus determined that he would be the king of a new order of gods. They were the third generation of gods. In the beginning, there were the primordial beings like Chaos, and Uranus and Gaia, and then there were the Titans like Cronus, and now these new ones called themselves gods. And they decided to have their headquarters in Mount Olympus. Poseidon and Hades drew lots as to what their responsibilities as gods were to be. They had the choice of the sea and the underworld. Hades took the straw that Zeus was holding, two straws, one short than the other, and he said, "No, my love. Probably in the ocean." Because he was a very gloomy soul. But he was very lucky on this occasion. He got the underworld. So he disappeared to the underworld, and he didn't live in their new home, Olympus. Poseidon took the ocean. Demeter took flowering things, all things that grow. Her Latin name is Ceres, from which we get cereal, breakfast cereal. Poseidon, of course, the Romans called Neptune, and Hades they called Pluto. Cronus, incidentally, was called Saturn. So you can see we've stocked the planets with these gods so far. Venus was Aphrodite, and we now have two sons of Hera and Zeus who immediately started breeding, and the first was called Ares, and he was a very unjust piece of work, and still is. He was the god of war. He more or less immediately fell for Aphrodite, and they did have children. He was known as Mars to the Romans, and the other one was Hephaestus. Hephaestus was so ugly. He was small and dark and hairy as a baby. That Hera, in disgust, having given birth to him, flung him down from Olympus, where he hit the beach very hard indeed. And he had a limp for the rest of eternity. But she took pity on him, and he came back and displayed extraordinary skill as a smithy, a maker of things. And the Romans called him Vulcan, which we get volcanoes. He had a fire going at all times, making things for the gods. One of the first things he made was that the three Cyclops came to give obeisance to Zeus, and they gave the power they had over thunder and lightning. And Hephaestus forged that power into thunderbolts, which became Zeus's signature weapon of choice. And he was very, very, very impressive. And he could ping someone out of the crowd. All the way from the top of Olympus with his thunderbolt. Right, okay, sorry, we're just beginning to establish now the 12 gods of Olympus. There are a few more to add. Zeus started to have affairs almost as soon as he was connected to Hera. And he had one with a nymph called Leto. And they had twins. And the twins were Artemis and Apollo. Artemis Diana, Apollo, and she was in charge of hunting and the moon and childbirth, because as soon as she was born as a twin, she helped her mother, Leto, give birth to her brother, Apollo. So she was the goddess of female pain and childbirth and virginity and all kinds of different things. Rather powerful, extraordinary woman, goddess, I should say. And Apollo, of course, was staggeringly beautiful. Harmonious figure of golden curls, which are the sun, and he was also mathematics, prophecy, lots of different things. And Zeus then had an affair with a Titaness called Metis, and
He'd barely finished, but he remembered another prophecy, these happened a lot, that any male child he had with Metis would destroy him. So, if you remember, Uranus was destroyed by his son, who in turn was destroyed by Zeus, and Zeus was now concerned about any son of his and Metis. So he did what he thought was a smart thing to do, probably taking a leaf out of his father's book, is he swallowed Metis while she was still pregnant. And he was then walking on the beach, and he had simply terrible cold, a monstrous cold that developed into a headache of a kind that you can't even imagine, a divine, godlike headache of such horror that his roar shook the world. And Hephaestus, thinking this was the only thing to do, took a Minoan double-headed axe that he had handy, and he swung it on Zeus's head. It came right down, and it cleaved his head in two. It opened up like that. And what do you think came out? Well, you know, what came out was a woman, fully armored, shield, spear, helmet, beautiful grey eye, many people's favourite god. She was called Athena. She was certainly the Greeks' favourite, or certainly the kind of Greeks' favourite god, because they named their biggest and best city after her, Athens. And she was a goddess of wisdom and cunning and battle and all kinds of things, and handicrafts and weaving, and goodness knows what. And fully armed, she came out of Zeus's head, and Zeus actually loved her. He was probably her favorite, his favourite child. His head somehow went back together again. And so we've got most of them now. I think there's one more to come to make the duo the duodecathon, the 12 gods of Olympus. And he's a charmer, actually. He's really extraordinary. His mother was Maya, who was a beautiful Titaness as well. And when he was born, he was instantly rather brilliant. The first thing he did when he was a baby is he crawled out of his cradle and he went around the countryside until he saw a herd of quite beautiful cattle. And he thought, I'm going to have those. I'm going to steal those cattle. This is a baby. And he thought, I don't want anyone to know it was me. So he put sort of leaves and brushes, bits of brushwood and so on, under his feet and under the feet of the cattle, and led them away back to home where his mother Maya was asleep in front of the fire. And then he did a few things with the cows and nipped back into his cradle and fell asleep. And meanwhile, these cows were very special cattle. They belonged to Apollo, and they were sacred and extraordinary cattle. And he was furious when he saw them missing. Someone, they say it was the birds, sneaked on this little baby god, whose name was Hermes. And so Apollo turned up and saw this baby, and he saw Maya. He said, hello, cousin Maya. And she said, hello, cousin Apollo. He said, that baby has been stealing my cattle. He said, ridiculous. And he gave birth to him yesterday. Absurd. And the baby said, will you be quiet? Some of us are trying to get sleep here. Jesus, didn't say Jesus. That's confusing. Papa says, look, there's something strange going on here. And then he heard a move. He said, whoa, wait a second. He went around and saw his cattle. He said, there's my cattle, all but one. And Hermes said, well, I've invented something, and I had to kill a cow to make it useful. He said, you killed one of my secret cattle. He said, oh, wait, listen. He picked up this thing, and he had a cow gut all the way down it. And he started to play on it with his fingers, his baby. Apollo fell to his knees in front of his child and said, that is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. I want it. I need it. I want to be in charge of it as a god. What do you call it? He said, well, I call it music. He said, well, what can I give you to make it? Well, he said, he threatened to kill me if he killed the cattle. You can not do that. And also, you can make sure I have a place in Olympus. He said, you're just a baby. He said, yes, but I'll be a brilliant god.
And so they went to see Zeus, and he told Zeus, he said, look, I'll do anything, I'll be great. He said, I'm good at stealing things, so I'll look after thieves and rogues and vagabonds and so on. And I'm quick on my feet, I'll messages. In fact, I can conduct souls to the underworld if you want, I'm good at that. Hephaestus immediately fell for him. They all fell for him, they all gave him a place. There wasn't a spare place because there were already 12 children. So Hestia, whom I've mentioned, but you may think, who the heck is Hestia? She's not very celebrated as one of the gods, and she was for a short time one of the 12. She was the goddess of the hearth and the home, very important goddess. The Romans called her Vesta. You've probably heard of the Vestal Virgins, who served her in temples in Rome. But and she gives her name to the English word vestibule. And you may think, it's not much of an achievement of a god, is that you gave the world the word vestibule. But she was kind, and she hated fighting, and she didn't like to see the gods really being nasty with each other. So she said, I'll step down from Olympus, and Hermes can take my place. So she stepped down. She said, my place anyway is in the homesteads of the people around. So that's what happened, and Hermes became. So now we have the 12 gods, Zeus and Hera, the top two, and Hephaestus, and who was Hestia, of course, as we mentioned, and Ares, and Aphrodite, and Athena, and Demeter, and, you know, you've got Artemis, so Apollo. So they now are ready to rule, and the only thing that's important to happen is there's a wedding. Wedding Zeus and Hera seals it all, gets it ready. And this is a bit like Kubla Khan, actually. What Zeus decided to do to please Hera is he announced the wedding and said that he would grant the wish of any animal, any species on Earth who could come up with a foodstuff that would be the best food for their wedding and possibly even for the gods from then afterwards. And it was open to all. So all the animals were furiously busy. Again, my cooking shows. Even here in Australia, there was a pink snatch bandicoot which came up with a rather revolting long stick of chocolate that he tried to explain the use of, and nobody quite understood it. And it was also clashed with a rather more successful pair of sticks of chocolate that a couple of wombats had put together. They were called Timothy and Tamara. And they had this idea that if you took some wine or something like that, you could suck up through the things. It was Timothy and Tamara's idea of a, they call it a slam. It's our Timothy and Tamara slam. It came, I think, about fifth. It didn't do badly at all. Amalthea, the nanny goat, who brought up Zeus, and obviously he had a soft spot for, she came out with cheese, which was a huge success, and came second. But what came first was this little creature called Melissa and her friend Ambrose. And Melissa was a bee, and she had gone round from flower to flower to flower to flower to flower to flower, collecting nectar. I mean, an unbelievably difficult job. And she'd got a little pot of it. Ambrose had a clever way of serving it, mixing it with wine, and they offered it up. And Zeus said, that was extraordinary, it's beautiful. What do you call it, Melissa? She said, well, call it honey. But it's going to be the wedding food. And this mixture, Ambrose, that you've done with it in the wine, that is, we'll name that after you, call it Ambrosia. And we'll have that as our food of the gods, because it's absolutely fantastic. So name your reward. And Melissa said, well, it is an enormous effort to prepare this honey. You've no idea how much it takes. And people just come and steal it. So I'd like you to give me, much as the scorpion has a sting and many snakes have venom, I'd like you to give me a sting. A sting so powerful that it kill anyone that tries to take my honey. There was a rumbling in the heaven. Zeus didn't like that, he thought it was selfish. Zeus wasn't very good at keeping promises anyway. He said, I'll give you something. I'll give you your sting. But because you've been so selfish, when you sting someone, the sting will be barbed and stay in their body when you try and fly away. It'll pull out your guts and kill you. To this day, that is the problem that he has with his sting. And Melissa, you may know, is the Latin word for a honeybee. But you may not know that, what should we do if you're an entomologist, that the order to which bees belong is called Hymenoptera, which means wedding wings. So to this day, they remember the time they made honey for the big royal wedding. So, we've got what looks like a pretty happy, ordered and interesting world, a universe, with gods running all kinds of different things. Zeus is now married, he's had the run of a lot of titanesses and nymphs, oreads and mountain nymphs, dryads and tree nymphs and so on. Now one day he's sitting there, he's a little depressed and annoyed with life. And along comes his friend, and he is a friend, Prometheus, who's the youngish Titan, son of Hyperion. Very thoughtful fellow, very likable. And he says, Majesty, you seem a little unhappy. What is wrong? The whole of Olympus is ordered beautifully, but there are stone thrones, beautiful fountains, it's ambrosia to drink, and well, what could be missing? So you said, it's very hard to put my finger on it, he said, but there are all these immortal beings, the titans, and gods like us, and nymphs, and cyclopes, and there's other monsters and things like that, but the animals are interesting in their own way, and some of them made some very interesting foodstuffs for our women. And they die, they're not immortal like everybody else. But wouldn't it be interesting if there was an intermediate species? A species a bit like us. Arms, legs, eyes, you know, sometimes beards, sometimes not. Two genders, like, you know. Do you think that'd be a good idea? Prometheus said, well, it's interesting. So a whole new species, and they would be immortal. No, so why? They would not be immortal. They would be highly mortal. They would live out their lives and then die. We could sit and just watch them. What's the point of that? Said Prometheus. And Zeus said, well, they could worship us. They could make offerings to us, sacrifices. They can praise us. And then Prometheus thinks, I don't know what it is. He wants an endless stock of beautiful boys and girls to shine. Because he had run through nearly all nymphs and nymphesses and, you know, beautiful everything that he could. They were immortal and had lots of children by them. But Prometheus, to some extent, was right. Now, also, Zeus, I think, was just curious to make a new species, to see if he could do it. So Prometheus said, well, how should we set about it? How do you make a new species? What are we going to call them? He said, well, man. That's a good idea. Anthropos, they deserve to go to man, yes. And Zeus said, well, you go to one of the dark caverns and see if you can speak with Gaia. But essentially, her order fell from power, but she was still Mother Earth. She was in time and about everything to do with the earth. She was harder to contact. So, can we go out and ask her to find them to make some sort of substance? So he wandered many, many days, many weeks, and then he found a cave where he could speak to Gaia. And he asked if she might provide some substance. And she told him where to go in a nice way. And he found this material he would call clay. So he set about obeying Zeus's orders. He took the clay, and he shaped it into people. And he did many, many of them, male and female people, of course. And he thought it would be interesting if they had different colours. So there were brown, black, white, pink, green, purple, all those colours. And then, just as he was finishing, he was drying in the sun, the substance is clay, it moulded, this eagle view ground and landed with a great whirr of its wings. It was Zeus, of course, who liked often to pretend to be the eagle. And Zeus enthusiastically clumped towards Prometheus. He said, "Look out, tis you!" Oh, great. So they're not going to be any green or purple people. Which is a great loss, we can all feel. And Zeus said, "You've done very well." And Prometheus said, "Well, yes, I've made this, these mannequins, but it only it needs you to breathe life into them." Zeus took each one of these shapes, these mannequins, and breathed into them. And breath, of all the languages of our culture, breath means spirit, aspirate, and atma, Sanskrit, breath means soul. And this divine soul was breathed in to each of these creatures. As you step back, and Prometheus stepped back, and they wriggled, and they straightened, and they laughed when they looked at each other, and they smiled, and they hugged each other, and they danced, and Prometheus went back with Zeus and said, "Wow, I love them, I've made them, and I love them more than anything. May I look after them, may I move amongst them, and I'll teach them how to make things, how to count, how to order their lives, how to plant, how to grow, fire." And Zeus said, "No! No fire. They are not to have fire." He said, "Fire will make them too independent. I don't want them to have fire. They are not to have fire. But then, the food, they can have as much as they want. They can have the fish in the oceans. Well, sushi, yes, but they can't eat it. They're not cooking it. It's no use, is it?" So they'd be perfectly happy without fire. Perfectly happy, much happier. Prometheus said, "Okay." So he moved amongst these species, which propagated and flourished and did well and grew and sowed seeds and it was happy, but it didn't have fire, so it didn't have a way of making ceramics, making ironwork or bronze, and cooking food, of course. So, and Prometheus got more and more obsessed with this as a problem. And eventually, he could bear it no longer. He did something extraordinarily brave, extraordinarily foolish, extraordinarily heroic. He went to Olympus, and with a fennel stalk, dry in the centre, he went to where there was a flame. He stole the flame, came down on us, and gave the fire to man. When Prometheus gave fire to man, gave the divine spark to man, because that fire is the fire of creativity. It's every kind of fire, the dark fires of industry, as well as the wonderful, wonderful fires that make beautiful things, and the fire inside. A little later that night, Zeus looked down from Olympus, and he saw fires burning all over the land, and his rage was terrible. Caused Prometheus to be taken, bound against the rocks of the Caucasus Mountains. And every day he sent two eagles to tear away Prometheus's liver. And every day, after the agony of the attack from the eagles, the liver would grow back. And the same thing would happen. The immortal Prometheus could be killed, he could be tortured for eternity. For the Greeks, Prometheus was a saviour, one who sacrificed himself for humanity. Not the first saviour or sacrificer of themselves for humanity in world religion, but earlier than some. Aeschylus, the great playwright, of course, wrote Prometheus Bound, play about Prometheus. And Shelley, the poet, wrote Prometheus Unbound,
and his sister Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, the modern Prometheus, which is in subtitles, because it's about someone who tries to make a perfect man using a spark of electricity. So our divine spark is something that we got from the gods, but the gods didn't want us to have it. And ever since, they were jealous of man to some extent. But Zeus had created man, and despite his fury at the fact that man now almost stood proudly fronting off against the gods, there were still generations in which the gods would move amongst men. They would do more than that. They would do very terrible things. The first thing they did, perhaps of relevance, is Zeus had an affair with a mortal woman for the first time called Semele. And she became pregnant. And once again, Zeus decided it was a bad idea because, well, Hera was furious, his wife. She didn't like the idea that he had sex with Titanesses and nymphs, but humans, too much. The fetus was torn from Semele, it's all very unpleasant, and sewn into Zeus's thigh, so it could develop there, so that in case Semele was going to be attacked by Hera. And the child was eventually born from the thigh, and its name means twice born, Dionysus. And he was a truly great, a beloved god of the Greeks, because he was, of course, the god of wine and antique revelry. The Romans called him Bacchus. Now he had an old man called Silenus, who was very much his tutor. And this is the first of a series of stories, many of which you will know, but I'll tell them, I hope, quickly and pertinently, because I think they're so fascinating. The first of many which involves a human being getting in trouble with gods. Now there was a king of Phrygia called Midas, and he was a rather likable figure. He was really charming. When he was a baby, ants walked across his mouth, depositing grains of sand. You and I might think that was just an unhygienic nuisance, but it was considered by the augurs at the time that it would mean he would become very rich. Well, Midas played host to Silenus when Silenus was so drunk he didn't know the way home. And Midas very kindly looked after him and his retinue. And Dionysus got to hear about this and said, I will grant you a wish. We're used to these stories where wishes are granted, and I think you know the wish that Midas made. He was rather fond of money, and he thought it would be a marvellous, marvellous gift if everything he touched turned to gold. So he made the wish, and Dionysus giggled and granted it. And then Midas woke up. Seems to have happened while he was asleep. And he was in his palace in Phrygia, and he thought, oh, that's very silly. And he got up, and he went, as he normally did, for a walk in the garden. And he went towards the window, and servants opened it. So he stepped out, and he'd forgotten about his dream, really, by this time. And he went towards what was the most famous rose garden in all of Greece. And he leant forward and picked up a rose. And instantly, it just kind of made a little creaking noise. And it was gold, solid gold, heavy gold. He couldn't believe it. It was too fantastically wonderful. Oh my goodness, he touched another one and the same thing happened. And then a butterfly lighted on his hand, and he watched this butterfly turn into gold. He put them all in his pocket, not that they had pockets in those days. And then his sister called out and said, how's everything? He said, fine, absolutely wonderful, everything is more perfect than it's ever been. And she said, well, Nestia is coming down to see you. She got a surprise from Nestia, her daughter, his niece. And Nestia skipped out. Before he could do anything, she'd run right up to him and hugged him and turned into a gold statue. And he thought, and I have said, I'd probably think the same. I'll think about this later.
And then he went in for breakfast. And that was bad. Breakfast was a mess, as you can imagine. If everything you touch turns to gold, it's not going to be easy to have a very satisfying breakfast. And the apples turned to gold, the cheese that had come from the everything was gold. And he was beginning to starve. His sister started shrieking at him about the fact that his niece was now on the statue. And it was all getting a bit awful. He didn't know what to do. He sort of bound himself like this and just wandered around, not touching anything, thinking it's really hopeless being rich. It's no good to anybody. I realize now the only riches worth having are friends, he didn't say. he went to bed. And he slept, and he screamed in his dream to Dionysus, please, please, let me off this awful curse. It's my own fault, I'm a fool, I'm really sorry, you taught me a wonderful lesson. Please, please, please. He's told to go and wash himself in the river Patroclus. So he goes to the river Patroclus and washes himself, and all the sand in the river turns gold. And almost to this very day, it has been a place where people pan for gold. Nuggets of gold could be found. You'd think Midas would never ever have anything to do with gods again, but in fact what he did, as someone who'd experienced what he had might be expected to do, is he rather went for the countryside and eternal values of trees and things, because he'd seen what happened when you turned a flower into gold. It was no longer a flower, it was no longer really beautiful, and so he became a bit of a hippie, to be honest. And he spent his time in the countryside, and he was wandering along one day, and his friend Tmurs, who was a mountain god, a sort of minor god, said, oh, good to see you, Midas, you can help us with this competition. Pan and Apollo are having a playoff musically, then you can help judge. So he goes along, and there are a few other people making these decisions with them. But essentially, Pan, who was interested, a son of Hermes, with goat's feet, he played the pan pipes, played El Condor Pasa. rather be a hammer than a nail, you don't like that. And everyone clapped and said, that's unbeatable, that's a superb, no one could beat that. And then Apollo with the lyre that, of course, Hermes had made and taught him to play, he played My Heart Will Go On, Bunny Rabbit, and everybody just batted their eyes and sold. And so all the creatures gave the award to Apollo, except Midas, who dissented. He'd become so hippie, he preferred lamps. And Apollo was a vain god, and he said, you, Midas, have ass's ears. Midas suddenly sprouted a pair of ass's ears. This was embarrassing. He was maybe hippish, but he was still a king. He was still a king of Phrygia. If all his rivals knew that he had ass's ears, he would be mocked out of his court, out of his power. So he kind of wore turbans for a while and let his hair grow and grow and made sure it was covered up so no one could see his ass's ears. But the only person who did know he had ass's ears, of course, was his barber, who cut his hair every 3 months. And Midas had said to him, if you tell anyone that I have ass's ears, I will kill you. I will start with your testicles, and then I'll pull your skin back, and I'll pour boiling lemon all over you until you die in the worst agony you can imagine. I've said, please, Your Majesty, at discretion, the things I've seen, you wouldn't believe. I promise you, not a word, I promise. Very well. Well, of course, you can't keep a secret like that, really, can you? I mean, you want to tell someone. If you do someone's hair, especially if they're a king, and you know they've got ass's ears. The fact is, you just got to say. Well, he was wise. He knew that the death that had been threatened to him was too violent for belief. So he went out into the countryside. He dug a hole by the river under a tree. And into the hole he called, Midas has ass's ears. He covered it up. And he got it out of his system. Thank God.
know what? Out of the earth, into the grass, the long grass, and the susurrating whisper. And the tree above them. And the rushes in the riverside. Soon the whole countryside was saying, Midas has as his ears. And everyone was laughing at Midas. And Midas went to the barber. And the barber closed his eyes, ready to accept his fate. And Midas said, my dealings with the gods have taught me. We and the gods are proud and foolish. So the best thing we can ever be is humble and wise. And in that spirit, I forgive you. As he said it, his ears disappeared. I think that's very pleasing. But isn't it odd how sports commentators say, oh, he's already got the Midas touch. Well, that would be disastrous. The whole point of that story is you don't want the Midas touch. Well, a couple of stories if you're in the mood for them. One of my favourites concerns a son of Apollo. Apollo was in charge of music, thanks to Hermes, as well as prophecy and oratory and harmony. It was also in charge of the sun. In fact, every morning he had to get into this huge chariot and drive this golden chariot across the sky. The gates would be opened by Eos, dawn, and aurora. And then it would end up in the twilight gates before Selene, the moon goddess, rode her silver chariot across the sky. He had a number of offspring, as Zeus had many of the others. And one of them was a boy called Phaeton. And Phaeton was at school, and he had a number of school friends, and some of them were perfectly ordinary humans. Some of them, like him, were the sons of gods. Epaphus was one who was son of Zeus. And Epaphus was incredibly annoying. I was saying, Zeus always sends for me. I go and see him in the room, I sit in his lap and sip ambrosia. He tells me he's gonna give me Egypt when I come of age. I'm gonna found a city there called Memphis, apparently. Well, what about your economy? You said your father was some sort of god. I was saying, my daddy's Apollo, the most beautiful, wonderful god in the world, so there. Really? So how often do you see him? This was the embarrassing thing. He'd never met him, he'd never seen him. He'd never seen his father. He just knew from his mother that Clamini, who Apollo had visited, that Apollo was the father. And he felt really bad, very annoyed to have Epaphus being so beastly to him, showing off all the time. And so Phaeton, of course, did what most boys would do, and he showed off too. So anyway, Apollo's going to let me drive the drive the sun one day. Oh, bollocks. No, he is. He's going to let me drive the sun, I'm going to do it. In fact, I'm going to do it the weekend. Yeah, after school. No, you're not. Yes, I am. Shut up. He goes home to his mother and says, no, I don't exist yet. He says, Apollo really is my dad, isn't he? Yes, darling. Is. I mean, could you be a blonde? There are other boys around a blonde. And I promise you, I wouldn't make it up. So if I went to visit him, did he say hello? I'm sure you would. Why don't you pack your lunch and you can go off and see him? So, pack a lunch. And he goes off towards the east so that he will get there one evening once the horses are ready in the harness, ready to take off for the next day. And after a series of adventures, he does indeed meet his father, Apollo. He says, all of you come here? Walk us along, we'll come here. He says, well, I'm Apollo, you are actually my father. Really? And your mother? Clamini. Oh, yes, I remember. Squealed like a... very lovely, lovely woman. Yes. Yeah, you could be my son. Yes, I see that. Oh, anyway, what can I do for you? He says, well, I've never met you before. No, yes, I'm sorry about that, but I'm busy, every day, sun to, parade across the sky, other things to do. He said, well, would you do something for me? yes, anything. Oh, there he goes again. Anything. He promised him anything.
I'd like to ride the sun, please, tomorrow.
Ridiculous. You're only 15. All right, how old are you?
I'll be 16 next year.
Well, no, you can't. This is ridiculous. No, 16 or 15 months, possibly.
You said anything. Yes, but you said anything. Yes, but I didn't. You said anything.
Oh, God.
Seriously? Yes, seriously. I'm going to do it. All he had in his head was a Paphos. I'm going to show off to a Paphos. He knew a Paphos had crossed the Mediterranean and gone to Egypt to buy out something. Real estate was going to be
So, dawn is approaching, Eos is getting ready to open the gates, and Phaethon's shown the horses, and they are huge, they are fiery, they are powerful beyond belief. And Apollo says, "So I can do to control them, you won't have a chance." "So I will, your son, of course I will, the sense my divinity in from you." So Apollo pops in the seat. Eos opens the door with her rosy fingers. He spanks the horses and they charge off. And he has never experienced anything like it. It is a magnificent feeling to have this power. Extraordinary. And they are going. They know the way. They seem perfectly happy. Everything's fine. And then, as the minutes pass, he thinks, "Now, come on, we've got to get near Egypt. Where's Egypt so I can buzz in Athens?" And he starts to let go slowly of his pressure, and the horses plunge downwards. And as they approach Egypt, he sees the earth singeing and burning the power of the horses as they're too close to the land. So he tries to pulls on the reins, and up he goes, over France, over Britain, over the North Pole. He's too high, he's almost going off into space, he's back down again, and he starts to go up and down, burning and freezing and burning and freezing the earth. And eventually Zeus is pointed out this terrible spectacle. He takes one of the sun bolts, he throws it like that, the sun comes crashing down. There's an eclipse. Phaethon is dead. And Apollo, very, very sorry indeed. The earth forever is scarred, some parts desert, some parts ice, all because of that foolish boy. Apollo decides to give to the Titan Helios the job of the sun. He's fed up with it. He only had bad memories. So Helios takes the job instead. And Helios is a brother of Selene, the moon goddess. And Eos, the dawn mentioned. And Eos had a fantastic taste in men. She found two Trojan princes. Both of them were astonishingly beautiful. One of them was called Ganymede. He was so lovely that she could barely look at him. It was just too terrifying. And unfortunately, Zeus caught sight of him. Said, "I'm having that." "You, Ganymede, Olympus, now, my throne, sit on it." And Ganymede became the cupbearer to the gods, his job basically was to call them, ambrosia gave to them. And the Latin for him is catamitus, which is catamite. The word catamite still exists in the language, as you probably know. And that comes from Ganymede. And Ganymede's brother, or at least cousin, was another Trojan prince over from the city of Troy, who was called Titonus. And Titonus was, some say, more beautiful. Titonus was so beautiful, people would compose poems to him, faint, hang around in the corner of bushes, hoping he would walk past so that they could just catch his eye. But he didn't put out. Titanus, some people call him. But Eos saw him, and he was dazzled by her pearly pink, beautiful, dawn-like beauty. Absolutely dazzled. They fell completely in love. It's one of the lovely stories. How much they fell in love. They completely, utterly adored each other. She was divine, she was immortal, he wasn't. But nonetheless, they loved each other with a passion
cannot be overstated. And it went wonderfully well. No arguments, no rows, just total joy in each other's company. Then she noticed, little sagging of the eyes here, little grey hair, was it there? Possibly. Still beautiful beyond imagining, but he was aging because he was human. And they sat and thought about it and realised that as the years passed, the inevitable would happen. So Eos went to Zeus and she said, "My Lord Zeus, I never asked anything of you, but I ask this with all my heart, as you have ever loved, as you have ever cared for another being, whether divine or mortal, can you please grant me the request that my beloved Titanus never die, to be immortal?" Zeus shrugged. "Very well." Spotted the loophole that Zeus had. Because he couldn't die, once she'd said that. He couldn't die. But she never asked him to stop Titanus aging. And he started to age. And he aged and aged and aged. And his face fell in, and his body fell in. His voice became a croak. His hair was white and then fell out. There was no possible way he could die, because she had asked for immortality, but she forgot to ask for eternal youth. It was so unhappy and so unfair. She went to Zeus again and said, "Zeus, could you not have known what I wanted? Well, you must frame your requests rather better. Please don't let him cling on to life like this. Please. I cannot undo a promise to make one immortal. He will be immortal. But I'll see what I can do." So Zeus pushed out his hand towards where Titanus was lying, gasping, wheezing, rattling, creaking as a desperately old man, and turned him into a cicada. A cricket. And he hopped around happily, chirping his dry, scaly, ever-aged presence, and we hear them to this day. There are many other stories like that, and I'm sure you know them. There's Arachne and Echo and Narcissus. Many, many like that. But the reason I won't say obsessed, but the reason I love this world, this religion, if you like, is that the Greeks, who came up with it as a way of expressing their sense of how the universe and how the world worked, how faith worked, how love worked, how everything else worked, those early Greeks who came up with that moved then uniquely and extraordinarily and inexplicably moved into being a people who came up with logic, philosophy, mathematics, drama, epic poetry, public theatre, democracy, democratic justice, and all the things that we owe to the Greeks this day forward and always will. Something quite magical about what the Greeks have given us. And there's a time when the Republic of Greece now is in such trouble. The sovereign debt crisis is still threatening to overwhelm it. It's worth considering that however much it may owe, it will never be anything like the debt that we all owe the Greeks. And the wit and charm and splendor and energy that they poured into their understanding of the universe is unique. And it certainly gives me an enormous amount of pleasure. And I hope it did you. I hope it will continue to do that. Because in the end, we are as closely connected to those Greeks
as we are to any other race on Earth. Because we have two parents and four grandparents and eight great-grandparents and so on. And we're all of us descended from those breeds. We're also descended from Genghis Khan, of course. It's remarkable that they are a species, if you want to call the Greeks a species, a people, whose religion allowed all kinds of sexual fluidity, gender fluidity. After all, one of the children of Hermes and Aphrodite was Hermaphrodite. And they always had a wonderfully open view of how human beings should behave. And I'm doing an event in Adelaide in a week and a half, which is to celebrate 40 years of legal gay shenanigans. They asked me naturally about this. You see, I'm married. Thank you. It'll happen here. Same-sex marriage will happen here. Things have changed here enormously and will continue to. There's a lessening of the power of the bishops and the priests and the priors and the abbot and the fact is, it's inevitable. It's utterly inevitable. And it'll, the only thing that's remarkable about it will be how unremarkable it is. No one will think anything seismic has happened, except the individuals who have the seismic experience of a marriage, which is true for all. So that's a truly wonderful thing that is going to happen. I bet next time I come to Australia that'll be the case. Well, I'm hoping anyway. But I just want to thank you for coming. You've been extremely kind. And I would urge you, if you have a feeling for it, to turn to Robert Graves' Greek Myths, because I think you'll get a fantastic pleasure out of it. I've had enormous pleasure sharing it with you. Thank you very much.